Today's guest is Charles Sizemore. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Sizemore Capital Management. He's a frequent guest on CNBC, Bloomberg TV, and Fox Business News, and has been quoted in Barron's Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post.
Thanks for having me.
You know, could you give our audience a little bit of background on, how you got started with investing and maybe even take us back to your first successful trade?
Sure. So I knew from the age of about 10 that I wanted to go into this basic line of work. Now, I barely understood what it was, but I would watch my grandfather he would always sit in bed and he'd have his little yellow legal pad with his freshly sharpened pencils, and he would just be feverishly writing down stock ticker symbols. You know, this was before the internet. This was before everybody had access to everything all the time. He would just be feverishly writing down ticker symbols and prices. And I didn't have any idea what it was he was doing. I just thought it looked awesome. Like it may as well have been, you know, Egyptian hieroglyphics, but it looked amazing. And I would always ask him questions. You know, what is that? Like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I'm buying shares of stock. Wow, what's a stock? That sounds neat. And so from watching my grandfather trade just as a retail investor, that really put the passion in me to pursue this as a career, you know, years later.
And so, what stock did you buy first after, you know, listening to your grandfather?
So my first big boy trade when I was, out of college, you know, had a little money in my pocket and able to actually place trades for myself. I actually bought, one share of Microsoft. So this was towards the end of the dot-com bubble. And, you know, it was, I'll refrain from telling you what my return on that share of stock was because my timing could have been a little bit better. But I do remember it. That was, hey, look at me. I'm placing my first trade. And it was really good, actually, that I started my life as an investor in the middle of the dot-com bubble and burst, because there's really no better time to see if you're up for this than to be tested by a major bear market.
Exactly. I mean, dot-com was an interesting era. What I want to do is take back to what you said in terms of your line of work. How did you get the idea, you know, of going on your own, and how did that come about?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of, I would say my story is similar to a lot of people in that you end up going solo because at the time you feel like you don't necessarily have a choice. You feel like this is the obvious move. So when I got out of graduate school, did my undergrad, worked for a few years, went to graduate school. I went back and I started working with a small RIA that ran some managed accounts, published research, did all of that. It was great. You know, I got to wear a lot of hats. I really got my feet wet in the industry, got a lot of good experience. But at the end of the day, I was a junior portfolio manager. I could give my opinion, but if the senior managers had their own ideas, then I would get overruled. So I decided around 2008 that it was time for me to go it alone. My employer at the time was very bearish on the market post meltdown. Yeah, I had thought that it was likely the bottom was in. It made sense to take a more more bullish orientation. I didn't know that the bottom would be exactly in March of 2009. Of course, nobody did, but I knew that we were getting close. And so with my employer's blessing, I actually did start my firm, and I started managing a few smaller accounts, personal capital, some friends and family, just to sort of get the processes down, to get the logistics of running it down. And then I ended up jumping in with both feet 2 years later in 2010.
And so starting your own firm, you know, it seems daunting in terms of, you know, how do you pay for your own living expenses while also running a business that would generate enough revenue? So after those family and friends, how did you end up finding investors for your firm?
Sure. Now the traditional model, there's my model and there's the traditional model. You know, the traditional model is you work for a broker dealer. You know, they sort of help you with some of the marketing, that they help you get started. And, you know, of course they take their pound of flesh, but you go that route. For me, my practice was very much a product of the internet era. Really, you know, we didn't call it social media back then, but the social media era as well. I produced a ton of content. I wrote articles anywhere that would publish me. You know, I started with some of the online platforms that were at the time kind of the Wild West. They would really take anybody that had anything to say. Such as, you know, Seeking Alpha, for example. I then, after I got something of a following there, I branched out to other publishers. And what happened was the client started coming to me. I found out you had to play to your strengths. And I wasn't a good cold caller. Yeah, I wasn't very effective at just drumming up business. But what I was good at doing is articulating ideas. And you make good content, you create something of value, and you get it in front of enough eyeballs, eventually what happens is people read that. It makes sense to them. And then they call you. At that point, getting a client is easy because they already feel like they know you. They've already read your research for some period of time. They are familiar with what you're doing, and they're not defensive. Whereas if you call somebody out of the blue, their defenses are up. You know, they don't want to be sold, you know? So, it's interesting. The way I grew my practice would not have been possible even 5 years before I started it. Now, you know, anybody with anything interesting to say can build a following and use that as a springboard.
And I know one of the things we had mentioned in our previous conversation is you started with using a separately managed account. Now, many people may not be familiar with what an SMA is. Now, walk us through that process of going through the SMA route.
Sure. So I'll back up just a little bit with that. So when you start managing investor capital, you have to get all the licenses. You have to get the registrations with the state securities board, with the SEC, et cetera. Yeah, you have to go through all that. All of that is not exceptionally difficult. It's a little bit time consuming, but it's easy enough. Now, once you have all that done, managing client accounts is fairly easy these days. And the easiest way to get started is with a separately managed account, because essentially the client just opens an account with a major broker, whichever one, TD Ameritrade, Schwab, just pick one. And then you manage their account, generally bucketed. You know, so you may have several clients with a similar risk tolerance. You would run a similar model for all of them. And then these days, the block trading technology is widely available. It's extremely easy to place a single trade. Let's go back to Microsoft. Let's just say I wanted to buy Microsoft for, 10 clients in a particular model. It's no problem. You place one trade, and the system pushes it down in proportionate amounts to each client. That's what makes running SMAs today so ridiculously easy. In the past, it was actually difficult and expensive. Today, it's easy. If you have a good model, the nuts and bolts of that are easy, and it's essentially free to execute.
And I know Interactive Brokers has a platform that does that. But let's say, for example, if a pre-SMA, someone is using, Thinkorswim platform, which is a retail software, and they don't want to give up a lot of the bells and whistles that Thinkorswim provides. And let's say in TD Ameritrade Institutional, they have, I think, ThinkPipes, which is similar, but they don't have a lot of the bells and whistles of Thinkorswim. So how does someone go about using the same type of platform like Thinkorswim, trying to do SMA for clients?
Yeah, so there's what you as the advisor see, and there's what the client sees. And that's a little bit frustrating to me, because to me, in this age of transparency, the client should be able to see everything. But a lot of times what ends up happening is the advisor gets all the bells and whistles. But what the client sees when they log in is they basically see the account balance. You know, they don't get to see all of the tools. So most clients don't necessarily care, because they want performance, but they don't, to borrow that metaphor, they don't care how the sausage is made. They just want to see the sausage, right? But there are some clients who really like all those bells and whistles and like to see it. In those cases, sometimes you do have to be a bit more creative. You might not be able to go the traditional kind of off-the-shelf SMA route. You might have to create something customized for them.
Got it. And let's say somebody does want to go SMA route today. I know you when you started off right after .com, but let's say if somebody were to do SMA today, what would be your recommendation and your advice, and especially in terms of finding investors?
Well, sure. I mean, the first order of business is, before you go look for a single client, before you do anything, you need to have a model. You need to have something to offer. You need to have something that is good, that's not like everything else already out there. So that's the hardest part, is just having the investment model. Once you have that, the rest is easy. All of these custodians these days are really aggressively looking for RIA business. They want it's a lot easier for any of these custodians, TD Ameritrade, Schwab, Interactive Brokers, for them to go after a single advisor that would potentially open dozens or hundreds of accounts. That's a higher probability. That's a higher what's the word I want to use? A higher return investment for them than going after onesie twosie clients. So they oftentimes will give away the a lot of the tools for free to advisors because they want you to gather assets for them. So at that point, it really just becomes a matter of finding the platform that you like for your trading. I would say some platforms are more sophisticated. Interactive Brokers is a fine example. It's an extremely sophisticated trading platform, but it can be a bit overwhelming for a retail client. Even a high net worth client who's relatively sophisticated, they may find it a little bit intimidating if they're not non-professional. Something like a TD Ameritrade or a Schwab or an E-Trade or what have you, these can be a bit more retail friendly, a bit more just the statements are easier to understand, the process to onboard the clients a little bit easier. So really, you just have to experiment with these and find the one that seems to fit you the best. Once you've done that, it's you shouldn't even try to get into this business unless you have at least a basic pipeline of clients more or less ready to go. You should test the waters first, reach out to old colleagues, friends and family, of course, anybody with capital that could potentially get you started. You should have them lined up before you take the time and expense and everything else of setting up a firm. This isn't a field of dreams. It's not you build it and they come. It doesn't work like that. I mean, you have to sort of have those pieces in place before you get started.
And the way you did it in terms of writing for seeking of other areas where you wrote and clients found you, is that still applicable today, or is that model not workable today?
I would say, if anything, it's even more workable today because 10, 12, 15 years ago, finding somebody on the internet that had interesting ideas and then picking up the phone and calling them was still a little bit, you had to be kind of a forward-thinking client to do that. I mean, that's not something that a kind of stodgy conservative person would have done. That was somewhat cutting edge at the time. I would say, as all that stuff has just gone mainstream, it's a lot. People are more comfortable doing that. Now, the other side of that is, of course, there's a ton of content providers now. I mean, there's just more people producing more content. So, you need to get out there and your stuff needs to be good. Now, one thing, a couple tips on that, if you want to get if you want to be taken seriously in this, always use your real name. I see people that publish under pen names, and I understand in some cases you have to because maybe your employer will not allow you to publish under your own name. I understand there are exceptions, but if you are looking to build a brand around yourself, build a business, then put your name on the door. That's how people remember you. If the name of your company doesn't have your name in it, it may not be easy to remember. Now, of course, if you're working with several partners, you don't necessarily have your name on the door, and that's fine. But if you're trying to build that name recognition, put your face on it. Don't put some ridiculous avatar. Get a nice headshot that you would put on a resume or something. Have that be what people see. put your name on it. You know, make it easy for people to see you, make it easy for them to remember you.
Got it. You build your SMA, and I recently saw that, you know, you build your own fund. And one of the things that says on your website is, you know, it's available for qualified investors. Maybe you can walk us through the difference between an accredited investor and a qualified investor. And even before then, just the process of how you transition from the SMA to your new fund.
Sure. So all these are good questions. I'll start with, you know, what's the purpose of having a fund at all? So starting a hedge fund is expensive. You do have to pay a law firm to draft the documents for you. And that's something you need to do. Like you can't just, you don't want to go cheap on that. Now you don't have to go to the most expensive law firm in town, of course, but you need good documents, one, to be taken seriously, and two, to protect you, just in case something goes bad, you need to have the right documents in place. Beyond that, there's other expenses. You don't want to do the administration of a fund yourself. That's a big compliance risk, and it's bad optics. And never mind the fact it's also just a lot of work. So you'll want to pay a third party custodian. They're not that expensive. They range from, you know, a couple hundred to a couple thousand a month tops. I mean, they're really not that bad. But that is an expense you have to consider. And if money is tight at the beginning, that's just one more thing to consider. You also have to get the fund audited every year. And that can also be pricey. If you go to sort of a mid-tier auditor, that's obviously a lot cheaper than a Big Four. But even that, it's going to be, you know, several thousand dollars a year. So before you go the route of launching your own fund, you should have a base of business already in place to where these additional costs, you know, make sense for you. And in many cases, it may never make sense. If you're doing something like a large cap stock portfolio, there's no compelling reason why you would have to do that in a hedge fund structure as opposed to doing it in an SMA. If it's liquid assets, it's really easy to do it either way. The reason where a fund really makes sense is if you're doing a strategy where size really does matter and it makes sense to pool assets, that's a fund can be really valuable there. And for example, our fund does a lot of complex options trading. We can't really do that in an account that has a couple hundred thousand dollars in it. It's the strategy just doesn't work. You know, we need a larger account size to execute it. And so pooling the assets into a fund, you know, is really the only way to go. Now, one issue with that is in order to avoid the financial regulation, people are scared of it. And for the most part, it's really not that bad. You know, the regulators aren't out to get you. They're reasonable people. They just want you to play by the rules. The issue is if you're launching a pooled vehicle for the general public, like a mutual fund or an ETF, it's the compliance is really expensive and it's really quite onerous. The beauty of a hedge fund is it's much less reporting. It's much less expensive to maintain. The regulatory regime overseeing it is just it's more relaxed. You know, if you're keeping your nose clean, if you're not doing anything wrong, the regulatory regime is very easy to get along with. And so, you know, that's why you might, you know, that's why you might want to go the hedge fund route instead of an ETF or a mutual fund. Now, the downside to that is with a hedge fund, you are limited to accredited investors. And depending on the type of strategy you're running, you may also be limited to what's called a qualified eligible person. So first, let's talk about an accredited investor. Accredited investor is someone who is has a net worth of over $1 million, and or along with their spouse has annual income of more than $300,000 over the last 2 years. What is the significance of this? If you're an accredited investor, the SEC determines that if you have that kind of income or that kind of accumulated wealth, you should be sophisticated enough to judge the merits of an investment on your own. You don't necessarily need the regulators to vet it for you as aggressively. And you're a big boy. You can kind of do this on your own, right? Yeah, that's the idea. Right. Now, if you use anything in the commodity sphere, you're subject not just to potentially to SEC regulation, but also to CFTC and NFA, National Futures Association. And it's a whole different set of rules, but the same idea applies. If you are what's called a qualified eligible person, and in this case, it means you have a net worth of over $2 million, or you have at least $1 million with the person doing the managing there, then you are seen as being a sophisticated enough investor that you're a big boy. You can take care of yourself. You don't require as much regulatory handholding. And so, you know, the beauty of going that route by limiting your fund to accredited investors or qualified eligible persons, you make your day-to-day compliance just much easier. It makes your life so much easier. There's also one last kind of practical point. A hedge fund, depending on how it's structured, is usually a limited partnership, and generally speaking, you're limited to 99 partners. So, you don't want to fill up those limited slots with smaller accounts. You know, you need to have a smaller number of large accounts, given that this is not infinitely scalable.
And so in terms of the fees for a hedge fund, you know, there's a management fee and a performance fee. If somebody is an accredited investor, correct me if I'm wrong, you cannot charge them a performance fee, only to a qualified investor that you're allowed to charge.
So that there's another wrinkle there. And of course, this again depends on if you're purely in securities or if you're in commodities as well. So it depends on what regulator you have to answer to. But yes, there's what's called a qualified client. And a qualified client is the net worth threshold changes over time. You know, it rises over time due to inflation. Right now it's at 2.1 million. So you're able to charge performance fees if someone is a qualified client, meaning in this case, they have a net worth over 2.1 million. Below that, I believe there are ways to charge performance fees, but it's very, it's tricky, and it's best not to go there. If you want to have the safest, most reliable compliance regime here, if you want to charge performance fees, make sure your clients are qualified clients.
Got it. And the way you found investors for your hedge fund, because, you know, if you look at the percentage of the people that would qualify as qualified clients, even taking the entire population of the U.S., is a very small percentage. So how did you end up finding clients that are qualified investors for the new hedge fund?
Sure. So for me, it was a process. You know, I already had a good sized client base from all of the work I did with the SMAs. Remember, I've been doing this since 2008. So when we launched the hedge fund, we already had a good list of existing clients, many of which met that threshold. So for us, it was very easy to get started. Now, the challenge, of course, is finding new qualified clients, because you can't really market when you're running a hedge fund. The SEC really limits what you're able to do. You know, you can't just put ads in the newspaper or something. You can't get on TV. I there's a lot of restrictions on how you're allowed to market, because they're not designed for the general public. And so for that reason, it really becomes a game of over the course of your career, just keeping a good Rolodex, you know, just remembering everyone you've ever talked to, call them up on the phone, talk to them, you know, if they qualify, if whether they do or they don't, ask them if they know people that do. And you just sort of build your network the old fashioned way. That's really, I mean, of course, these days you can even do it via LinkedIn, or you can do it via other medium, but you do have to be very careful, because you can't just advertise to the general public. I mean, that is against the rules. You have to build your list of pre-qualifieds first.
Got it. And one of the things I want to ask you was, posting, you know, there's different types of databases like Barclays Hedge and other types of databases where you can post your performance. Does that help a lot to bring in qualified investors, or that's just a waste of time?
Well, so it's not a waste of time at all. It's It's sort of a waiting game, though. So getting in every database you can, I would say, is a good idea. That's what I have done. But you don't really know who's looking at it because there's that wall between you. And so you could be, for all you know, you could have hundreds of people looking at your returns every month, or you could have nobody, you don't know. And then one day the phone call, one day the phone rings and, you know, it's an allocator looking to place a little money with you. So it's one of those games that can be very long and grueling because you don't know if you're making progress or not. You know, the thing is, somebody could be looking at the database every month, taking notes on you, following you, but you don't, and so you're making progress. Like you're slowly working towards an allocation with that investor, and you don't know until they call you. So in that sense, it can be very exhausting and very frustrating because you don't know, you really don't know what's happening. But I would say, yeah, when you're looking for capital, you should do the databases. It only makes sense to do the databases.
And talking from a Pareto principle, like where if you spend where you spend bulk of your time and where bulk of your clients are coming from, which type of marketing tactics you found the most successful to grow your business?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Something I've been doing lately, and this is within the last month, and so the jury's still out as to how successful it's been, is I've been looking for family offices and institutional investors on LinkedIn. I've just been reaching out and just offering to chat, just, you know, just saying, hi, please add me to your network and like, let's talk. And and this may be a product of the, you know, the post COVID-19 world we're in, but I think a lot of people are bored and actually just willing to pick up the phone and talk right now. And maybe they wouldn't have a few months ago because honestly, they're probably lonely. They just want to talk to somebody. And so I've been having some early success with that. Now, I don't know how scalable it is. I don't know how replicable it is. I don't know how I'll be able, I don't know if this will make sense a year from now when coronavirus lockdowns are a thing of the past and life in theory is back to normal. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. We'll see. In terms of, where do you get the most bang for the buck? I would say it's still referrals, you know, but if you get a strong referral, if you ask your existing clients, hey, if you like what I'm doing for you, please talk about me to your friends. That is still a really high probability of success avenue. Yeah. But by the time when someone gets a personal recommendation from somebody they trust, they're a lot more likely to go with that than they are to just, you know, respond to an ad or just respond to a cold call. So I would say, that old 80-20 rule, you get 80% of your results from, 20% of the effort. Yeah, the 20% of your effort spent on just good old fashioned referrals is probably the single most effective.
Got it. And I know we had touched on a little bit on your strategy, but I want to spend a little bit of time, if you don't mind, on your trading strategy. So with your SMA, what type of strategy we're using, and maybe you can take us through.
Sure. So we ran various ones, but the one that I like the most and the most proud of is the put option writing strategy. And so as far back as about 2012, I was already getting concerned about the low potential in traditional asset crisis. Tongue tied today. The low potential in traditional asset classes. Stocks were already starting to look a little bit pricey as far back as 2012 or 13. I know that sounds ridiculous now because they've just blasted off even more since then. But particularly fixed income had already started to look very, very pricey then. I did not like what I saw then, and I like what I see now even less. So that really led us to look for strategies that offer competitive stock-like returns, but accomplish what fixed income does in terms of lowering overall portfolio volatility and diversifying. And so one of the strategies we really came back to was very strategic put option writing. Now, writing puts, selling a put option that you expect to expire worthless can be a risky strategy if you don't know what you're doing, and if you sell too many contracts, like you're not really managing your risks. This is a strategy you have to be very, very on top of. You have to measure your risk well. But you're working, you know, the time decay of options works in your favor. If you sell options that are, you know, 5-10% out of the money, what have you, there is a very, very high probability that they expire worthless. So selling those options, collecting the time decay for some period of time there, and then closing it out, it's a high probability strategy.
And you know, how do you reduce risks with options? Because, for example, if somebody holding stocks, you know, they could do various strategies. For example, if something goes below a certain point, a certain price, they can automatically put that into, you know, build that into a script at Thinkorswim or what other platform somebody else might be using to sell it, or they can do some type of moving average. So how are you managing your options?
With options, it's fantastically easy. Like, that's the beauty of options. You can just do anything with them. And so the way I would best describe it is by example. So you know how an insurance company works. You know, insurance companies collect premium from all the policyholders, just collect premium, you know, day in, day out. Well, that's very similar to writing a put option, okay? Like, writing a put option is the same as selling an insurance policy. Somebody is buying that from you to reduce their risk. You're accepting some of that risk. Well, what do insurance companies do to limit their losses? They buy reinsurance, right? So in the options market, you can do the exact same thing. You sell a put option that is relatively close to the money. It's the strike price is relatively close to the money. You collect that option premium, and then you buy a deeper out of the money put option to limit your loss. That way, okay, you know, for whatever reason, something happens, the bottom falls out of the market, that option you sold all of a sudden goes the wrong way on you. And rather than collecting that premium and, you know, going about your business, you're actually underwater in that position and taking losses. Well, those losses can get capped by buying a put option that's deeper out of money. So it's exactly like buying reinsurance if you're an insurance company.
Got it. And what is the other side? What is the other side of the risk, or how things can go wrong?
So the nightmare scenario for put writing is not necessarily that the stock market, whatever that option is tied to. It's not so much that that declines in value, because, you know, the delta there, you know, the degree to which the option loses value relative to its underlying, that's not that big of a deal. So, you know, if the market goes down 5% and your option goes down by 5%, yeah, okay, that's tolerable. Where it becomes scary is there's, you know, options have the volatility component. You know, when that volatility premium blows out, if you are long options, that's great. You just potentially made a lot of money. If you're short options, that's where you blow up potentially. If you have a volatility spike, that time decay can go the wrong way on you and blow out. So that's why it's really important to understand the risk you're taking before you put the trade on, and make absolutely certain that you're prepared for that. Make sure that the position sizing is, if something goes the wrong way on you, it's not going to bury you. You know, that's it. I mean, like most people that end up blowing up in options, they blew up because they were writing too many naked options. They did not understand the risk they were taking, and they just, you know, they let it get out of control.
And for your current hedge fund, are you using similar strategy?
Exactly. We're using a very similar strategy. And the beauty of doing it in a fund structure is we don't have the limitations that come with you know, smaller account sizes. We're able to build out the structures in the option market exactly the way we want to do it.
Got it. And let me ask you one thing in terms of a little bit more about risk. You know, what is it that keeps you up at night about?
So what keeps me up at night more than anything? So, you know, you think it's if you're ready for something and it happens, great. It's, you know, what keeps you up at night is, what if there's this risk I haven't taken into consideration? You know, what if there's something coming around the corner? And I'll give you an example. Back in 2018, this is, you know, ancient history now, but we had that Volmageddon incident in January, February of 2018, where the market was just cruising along, everything was fine, and then boom, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, volatility spiked. It went from extremely low to extremely high. Well, we did have some options positions out at that moment, and what we normally do is, as volatility rises, we reduce our position sizes. Like, we dynamically adjust the amount of risk we're taking based on the volatility we see. When volatility is high, we have smaller positions. When volatility is low, we take larger positions. Like, we dynamically adjust that. Well, what happened was, but usually you see that happening. Volatility starts to increase and then it spikes, but it's a process. What happened to us in early 2018 was, volatility base, it's like went from, it's like a race car taking off, 0 to 100 in 20 seconds or whatever, or 2 seconds. You can tell I'm not very good at race car analogies. I kind of botched that one, but anyway, volatility went from extremely low to extremely high all of a sudden because a volatility linked product, there was a volatility ETF or ETN, blew up. No one really knows to this day. No one really knows what happened, but they think a couple of hedge funds attacked this ETF and caused it to blow up. Well, that caused, out of nowhere, it caused volatility to just massively spike. So that was a rough month for us. We took some losses, and the fear is always that something like that happens. So that's pretty well it.
And how are you doing?
We're doing great, actually. Our model worked the way it was supposed to work. So as I said, we're supposed to take less risk as volatility rises. And so as volatility rose in January and February, we dynamically adjusted our position sizing. So when March happened, we had very little exposure on. We took some losses in March. We were down about 3.5% gross, about 3.6 net. But that's okay. Like, that's within a tolerable risk bound, and we're actually slightly positive for the year. So, we'll take that.
And what type of what kind of stocks are you following or researching, or is there on your watch list where you might be interested in sharing some of your?
Sure. Insights? Now, in the option strategy, we're focusing on just index options, so we're not looking at individual names. Now, on some of the other things we run, I do run some dividend portfolios and some value portfolios. I look for where there's been the most damage, and right now, that's in energy. Now, I'm very careful with energy. Energy is a minefield right now, and a lot of these stocks are cheap for a reason, so you have to be very careful there. But I'm also looking at REITs and business development companies. I feel like in these sectors, the baby was sort of thrown out with the bathwater. And what we've seen this year is, the whole market collapsed in March. That happened. I mean, everyone saw that. But a lot of the big money was very quick to buy the dip and pile into large cap tech. That's where a lot of that money plowed back into, and that pulled up the indices. The indices are within striking distance of new highs. It's because they're so heavily cap weighted towards large cap tech. So when large cap tech does well, it just pulls up everything. Well, what's been really left behind are a lot of the real estate investment trust and business development companies. People are still very scared of those, and not without justification. I mean, this is a really rough time to be a landlord due to the retail closures from the virus lockdowns. But if you're selective, you can find some real gems there. Similar with business development companies. Business development companies are as close to Main Street as Wall Street gets. These are middle market companies that are generally too small to go directly to the stock market or public bond market for listings. So they go through the intermediary of a business development company. Well, because everybody is scared to death of Main Street right now, a lot of these business development companies are trading at some of the deepest discounts I've ever seen. So I think all of these are, you have to be patient. I don't know how long these things will stay depressed, but all of these seem like very, very nice places to deploy capital.
And just want to get your opinion about, the economic recovery. I know none of us have, can look into the future, but just based on your opinion, Do you think it's a type of a V recovery, or think you're more of a W, looking at
So,
somewhat like a W recovery?
there's the market, and then there's, of course, the economy. And what we've already seen in the market is, of course, a V-shaped recovery. Now, whether that's sustainable remains to be seen, but that's what has happened. In the economy, I flat out don't see it. You look around, I look around my neighborhood, and we've been spending a lot of time just sitting in lawn chairs in our front lawn, watching, kids go by on bicycles. And it's nice. It's quaint. It makes you feel like you're in like 1960s America or something. It's actually kind of refreshing to see kids playing in the street. I haven't seen that in decades. However, those kids playing in the street are kids that aren't going to summer camp. They're not going to the movies. They're not doing anything to spend money. And I think the risk we run is that people kind of get used to a more relaxed social life, and they're slow to go. I mean, even if the virus disappeared tomorrow, if, I don't know, just poof, there's no more COVID-19, it's gone. I don't know that everyone is just going to rush into the movie theaters. I mean, for one thing, there's been no movies produced in months, so there's no supply of movies to even put in the theaters right now. Restaurants, people would go to a few, but they've kind of gotten used to barbecuing in the backyard. Maybe they're not in a hurry to go back. Furthermore, perhaps they lost their job and they're still sort of hoarding cash for the next 6 months or so, just to make sure they're back on their feet before they start spending again. So I think it's going to be a while. Look at tourism, the airline industry. Now that a lot of meetings are done over Zoom or what have you, business travel may not return to previous levels for years. I mean, it's going to go back. At the end of the day, there's no substitute for a handshake. There's no substitute for a conference and in-person meetings. That's valuable. But there's a lot of marginal meetings that may just be on Zoom forever now. There's a lot of entertainment dollars that may just not get spent for a while. So I think, it's if we're picking letter shapes, I think L shape is how the economic recovery is going to go. I don't see any other outcome.
I haven't heard of the L shape, so that's very interesting. I wonder why you think there's a disconnect between the stock market recovery, which is you mentioned is a V shape, versus the economic recovery, where a lot of people have lost their jobs, people are not spending money. Why is there a disconnect between the market recovery and the
Oh,
economic
sure.
recovery?
And this
Just
is
your opinion.
easy, and it's obvious to anybody that looks. It's the Fed. And this is not a criticism of the Fed, I might add. If I were Jerome Powell and this was the mess that I was inheriting, I would have probably done more or less exactly what he did. But what it boils down to is the Fed has printed trillions of dollars and they're not done printing. And most of that is going into the financial economy. It's going into the capital markets. It's not necessarily going into Main Street. Now, a lot of it will trickle into Main Street, sure, but most of it is going into the capital markets. And so it's we saw this to some extent. The economic recovery between 2009 and 2019, call it. It was one of the weaker economic recoveries on record. It took a long time for employment to get back up to what we'd call full employment. It took a long time for wages to start to rise again. It was a slow, long slog, but stock prices massively outpaced economic growth. And a lot of it was loose monetary policy by the Fed. Well, we've seen that rather than, quote, change everything. The coronavirus, response to that has actually accelerated the trends that were already in place. And so you have an extremely accommodative Fed just trying to, trying to keep everything from falling apart, and creating all this liquidity that is going into asset prices. So that's it.
Charles, I really want to thank you for your insights and your time today. If one of our listeners wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for people to reach out to
Absolutely.
you
Go to
and find out more?
sizemorecapital.com. I just click on the contact tab and look me up. I'm happy to chat.